Good morning, may it please the court. My name is Charlene Aiken. I represent Rudy B. Hill, who's the appellant in this case. There are four issues I'd like to talk to you about today. The first is that the trial court abuses discretion in finding that father's motion to enforce permanent orders was groundless and frivolous under 1317-102. The second is that the trial court abuses discretion in calculating child support under 1410-122. And the third, that it abuses discretion in the modification of parenting time contrary to the party's agreement and the best interests of the child standard. And the fourth is that father's appeal here is not groundless and frivolous, nor is 1410-119 applicable for an appellate attorney's fees. The first issue under groundless and frivolous pursuant to 1317-102, the statutes and case law define frivolous as the proponent can present no rational argument based on the evidence or law in support of the claim or defense. And a claim is groundless if the allegations of the complaint, while sufficient to survive a motion to dismiss, are not supported by credible evidence. And the determination that a party is not entitled to relief does not necessarily make a claim frivolous. And the determination of entitlement to attorney's fees under 1317-102, the trial court must make adequate findings of fact and conclusions of law on the issue. Here, there was a motion to enforce permanent orders. The magistrate found that this was the fifth attempt to change permanent orders. The district court found it was actually the third request. Let's go through those requests. The 2010 motion to modify permanent orders was filed August 31st, 2010. This addressed refinancing of the property and requested enforcement of permanent orders, much like a contempt. And this was filed pro se by the respondent, the father. There was attorney's fees assessed with this motion. The July 27, 2010 motion to modify permanent orders was filed before permanent orders was even entered into the record and was an objection, more characterized as an objection to the proposed permanent orders presented by the mother's counsel. The motion to
Excuse me, just a second, Ms. Aiken. Somebody is receiving email and it's interrupting our court recording system. Please turn off any electronic device you have that receives email. Thank you.
It's affecting the timer.
I think it stopped. I think it stopped. Can I continue?
Yes, please.
Okay. And here we have a motion to enforce permanent orders, and it asked the magistrate to look at the party's personal property and to enforce this portion of the permanent orders. Now, in the reply to the motion to enforce permanent orders, it's inserted Rule 60A, which is a clerical error by the court, and asked the magistrate to review the partial transcript to determine if there was a clerical error that needed to be reviewed. The magistrate did such that, did review the transcript, unfortunately found that there was no clerical error, mistake, or oversight, and that there would be no relief under Rule 60A. But that determination does not make a claim frivolous. And the district court found that Rule 60A motion should have been brought for a separate motion for district court review. However, the magistrate invited this review, and therefore the motion was not frivolous and groundless. In addition, under the factors of 1317-102, which I won't go into each factor, conclusory statements that a claim is frivolous or groundless are insufficient for purposes of appellate review and inadequate to satisfy the statutory requirement. The district court and the magistrate both failed to make findings why father's conduct lacks substantial justification and discuss how the court arrived at the dollar amount of the award, other than granting the affidavit of attorney's fees. The magistrate made a conclusory statement that Father's motion was frivolous and groundless, and the district court stated that the magistrate's technical error as to the fifth or third attempt is not a specific finding, but just describes Father's litigious nature. So the district court even admitted that this is not a finding and just describes the bad faith by Father.
Are you saying that the amount of fees and the reasonableness of fees was not properly determined because in the face of no objection by your client as to those?
No, I'm saying you don't get to that step yet, that the step before, whether the motion was groundless and frivolous, and
so
sufficient findings.
The court made several pages of findings here, kind of laying out as you just did, but with a different perspective, obviously, why it reached the conclusion that when the father filed his reply brief in 2012.
What page are you on, Your Honor?
13 of his order.
Okay.
He requested the magistrate review the transcript, which had already been done like 2 years before, and had been denied once or twice or three times, it wasn't clear to me, and that that's what made the motion frivolous. So whatever the father, what the father had asked for in his reply brief, seems to me, as I read this order, building up to it, that's what caused the motion to, that's what was the groundless and frivolous action that the father took. Is there any law that says you can't find a request and reply brief to be the basis for a groundless and frivolous action?
Your Honor, I don't believe that the trial court prior to 2012 actually did review the permanent orders transcript and did look for a Rule 60A, whether there was a clerical mistake. The first time, the first motions involved basically putting together the final permanent orders and was objections to actually what was stated, because there was a hearing on June 18th and there was oral findings, and then there was a conference on that following Monday.
And the point of the conference was that, if I'm not mistaken, your client or the counsel representing your client argued that what was put in the written orders wasn't consistent with something that had been spoken about in the telephone conference, correct?
The counsel for my client actually stated that the written orders weren't consistent with the oral findings made on that Friday before.
Okay, and the telephone conference clarified that.
The telephone conference, which was unrecorded, mm-hmm. was clarifications of further questionings by counsel.
And your client objected to that clarification in 2010, right?
He had a form of proposed orders that was consistent with the June 18th.
And in 2012, he was still complaining about that correction, even though his complaint or objection had already been denied once or twice or three times before, correct?
Well, Your Honor, but the objection was to the form of proposed orders before permanent orders were entered into the case. And so it wasn't necessarily the same thing here in 2012, because this was looking at a clerical mistake made by the trial court judge, and that wasn't done prior to 2012. Father was without counsel when he filed his motion for review.
Okay.
I'm going to move on to the second issue. Excuse me.
You said it was child support, I think.
Yes. Thank you, Your Honor. The modification of child support, it's obviously an abuse of discretion standard, but the de novo, if the trial court applied the legal standards to its findings of fact under 1410.119. And when we look at the income that the magistrate imputed to mother for her actual gross income, it does not meet the standard under the statute. Mother had regular holiday pay time off and tax fringe benefits, sums of income, which should have been included as her actual gross income. and it was not, and even mother testified at the post-modification, or at the modification hearing, that she did not dispute her year-to-date income, or current income in 2012, was $3,800 a month, $3,843 to be exact, and the magistrate imputed her with $3,494 a month. And both of the documentary evidence also suggests, and this goes more into the overtime argument, that mother did receive overtime on a consistent and yearly basis. And her 2011 W-2, and her current paycheck in 2012 all show at least 9 to 10% of her income was overtime.
But Ms. Aiken, overtime pay is not included for child support purposes unless it's required by the employer. Isn't that correct?
That is correct. Under the case law, overtime pay is not included if it's not required as a condition of employment. But how do you reconcile someone testifying all that self-servingly that it's not required as part of employment, but then every year it is part of their income on a consistent basis, and to escape that as a requirement seems to be, you know, not testifying truthfully.
Well, couldn't the trial court have relied on Ms. Vigil's testimony that overtime was not required by her employment?
That is true. The trial court could have relied on her testimony, but I think it comes down to the weight of evidence, and you have self-serving testimony that says it's not required, but you have documentary evidence showing that every year you're getting overtime, and then you have on cross-examination saying, yeah, that is my income, and that didn't even include, the $3,800 didn't even include the overtime, because father's counsel said, well, let's just take out the overtime for purposes of this calculation. And also, in addition, the child care costs, the magistrate imputed $910 a month in estimated projected child care costs. Both parties admitted there had been a change in child care. The children were now school aged. The grandmother who was providing care was no longer providing the same time and amount of care. And there was no evidence that was presented by either party that mother or both parties was actually incurring $910 a month. And the case law is clear that in order to include child care in the child support worksheet, the cost has to actually be incurred and cannot be speculative in nature. And here, the $910 a month for child care was speculative.
Excuse me.
Yes.
Could you clarify that? Are you saying that there is no testimony that Ms. Vigil is actually paying $910 for child care?
There was the testimony that she provided was that she looked into what comparable full-time child care would be, and this was the projected amount, but there wasn't actually evidence saying, here's my check showing I've paid $910 a month in child care.
So was there any evidence of any amounts that had been paid for
child care?
That
was the amount that the parties were paying prior, when the children were not school age, when they required much more child care. So that was the amount that was agreed to by the parties at the time of permit orders.
So then your as I understand it, your concern is that you believe that the amount of child care should have been lower than $910 because it was
because there was a change in circumstances.
Because of the change in circumstances, but not that there was no payment being made whatsoever for child care.
Right.
Okay.
Exactly. And lastly, the health insurance premium, the court imputed $115 a month into the child support worksheet, which was the same figure as in the permanent orders. And this was 2 years later. There was evidence presented by father that the cost of health insurance had increased and his premiums were now $136.83.
As opposed to $115.
Correct. That's father's trial exhibit. I'm sorry.
A $20 difference.
Yes, and
that exhibit was a handwritten exhibit the father created, wasn't it?
It's actually father's
not from the employer. It's not from his employer.
No,
it's not his paycheck.
No, but there was his paycheck in the record, his current paycheck in the record.
Did it show a deduction of $130 for?
It showed, well, it broke it up into medical, dental, vision, and he's paid on a weekly basis. So it's actually $66.44 a week. So it was $34.54 a year.
Was that exhibit pointed out to the magistrate, or was it even identified in your brief?
I don't know if that exhibit was pointed out to the magistrate. It is in the record. It's page 14 and page 35 of the sealed documents, and it's his 4-8-12 and 1-15-12 paycheck. Can I reserve my remaining time? Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, my name is Robin Beatty, registration number 34284, and I'm appearing on behalf of the petitioner appellee, Cassandra O'Hare. She was formerly known as Cassandra P. Hill. The appellant has raised a large number of issues. I'm going to focus on the following points. First, I will address Colorado Rule of Civil Procedure 60A and describe why the respondent's motion to enforce permanent orders does not fall under its purview. Second, I will briefly describe the repeated litigation surrounding the division of personal property. And lastly, I'll reiterate the record support for some of the court's rulings regarding child support that the appellant addressed during her argument. Regarding the first point, that the court did not make a clerical error in this case, and that the magistrate considered the merits of the respondent's 60A motion, as you all are very well aware, Colorado Rule of Civil Procedure 60A is one of the few procedures whereby a court may revisit a final judgment. Respondent tells you that the motion to enforce he filed on February 11, 2012 was premised upon the argument that the district court committed a clerical error when it issued the permanent orders in this case. But if you look at the face of that motion, you will see that Rule 60A is not mentioned in that motion. Instead, the motion to enforce states that petitioner failed to give respondent the personal property he was awarded at permanent orders. In the petitioner's response to the motion to enforce, the petitioner described the many attempts that she had made to give the respondent his personal property. Those were attempts made over the course of years. The petitioner could not do so because the respondent would not set a time to meet and go through the list of personal property, which was what the court had ordered. In that same response, the petitioner noted respondent's failure to cite any legal authority to, quote, enforce the permanent orders. Now, in respondent's reply to our response to the verified motion to enforce, he cited to Colorado Rule of Civil Procedure 60A for the very first time. But the argument that respondent made in his reply on March 9, 2012 is the exact same argument he made on July 7, 2010 in his objection to the form of the proposed order. And he did submit the transcript to the district court when he objected to that proposed order. In both the 2010 objection and the 2012 motion to enforce, respondent's attorney argued that the court should adopt the language from the transcript of the June 18, 2010 hearing concerning personal property. But the court had modified that language, and the court considered respondent's proposed language in 2010, declined to adopt that language, and instead adopted the petitioner's language.
He modified it in the course of this telephone conference that had occurred after June of 2010, right?
Yes, Your Honor. The telephone conference occurred, I believe, 3 days later. During that time, the court clarified its orders regarding personal property. And unfortunately, that telephone conference was not recorded.
And counsel for respondent repeatedly said you didn't get it right when you then modified the order to reflect what happened in the telephone conference.
Yes, Your Honor.
And wouldn't let it go and still kept raising it all the way into 2012.
That is absolutely
That's
correct.
What the judge found to be groundless and frivolous about this motion.
Yes, Your Honor. So we 100% agree that 68 is an appropriate means to correct an order if the court originally intended to make one award, but instead made a different award, mistakenly. But if 68 applied to this case, and if the court had actually made a clerical error, the court would have corrected that mistake in 2010 when it had both parties' submissions after the telephone conference, after the submission of the transcripts. That was the first time respondent argued that this language was an error. Now, with respect to those prior orders, I do want to briefly go through those. The four orders that I am talking about are the order on July 19, 2010. That's the order of permanent orders. That's the order that ruled on respondent's objection to the form of proposed order, and that did, in fact, predate permanent orders. That doesn't mean it's not an order. That is the order where the court considered the same argument that it considered again in 2012. July 31, 2010 is the date that the permanent orders were issued. On July 31, 2010, the court also issued an order denying a respondent's motion for change to permanent orders. Now, I'll admit, that order did not address personal property, but it does provide a basis for the magistrate's finding that this was the fifth time the respondent had challenged the permanent orders. On September 7, 2010, the court issued another order. It was an order denying respondent's motion for to modify permanent orders. In that motion, respondent argued again the same thing that he argued in his motion to enforce in 2012. He argued that the petitioner did not give him his personal property within 30 days. Again, September 9, 2010, there was an order denying respondent's response to petitioner's motion to modify permanent orders. The court treated that as a reply because it was a reply. And again, in that reply, the respondent argued that the petitioner would not give him his personal property. Now, respondent cites In re the Marriage of Gomez for the proposition that the court cannot make conclusory statements that a claim is frivolous, groundless, or vexatious. He claims that paragraph 31 of the magistrate's order is conclusory and does not address all the factors contemplated by Colorado Revised Statute 1317-103A. In Gomez, the trial court did not explain why it regarded the claims as frivolous. It just said those claims are frivolous. But in our case, that's totally different. In our case, the magistrate described the respondent's prior attempts to change the permanent orders in great detail. Paragraph 31 is a conclusion coming at the end of the magistrate's recital of all of the respondent's past litigation addressing the same issue. The magistrate found that respondent's motion was groundless and frivolous because the respondent litigated the same issue over and over and over again and had no legal basis for that continued litigation. As she states in her order, the time for appeal had long passed. In re the Marriage of Emdinger states that the magistrate was not required to specifically address each factor enumerated in 1317-103. She was merely required to specify the reasons she found that the argument was frivolous and groundless. As far as father's failure to preserve the issue of the reasonableness of attorney fees, it sounds to me that the respondent has abandoned that issue. If he is making that argument, it must be noted he never made that argument at the district court level. The magistrate awarded the petitioner the amount of fees requested in her affidavit of attorney fees, and the respondent never contested the amount of those fees at trial. Now, briefly touching on child support, the court was very logical in the way that it calculated the petitioner's income. It used her hourly rate, multiplied her hourly rate by 40 hours per week, and then multiplied that by 52 weeks in a year, divided that by 12.
And therefore excluded any overtime?
Yes, Your Honor.
And why did it exclude overtime?
Well, Your Honor, I'm going to quote exactly what the respondent's counsel said at trial. He said, I'm not saying that she should have mandatory overtime. And he said, I'm asking the court to say neither of theirs is mandatory overtime. The respondent did not request that the petitioner's overtime be included in the calculation at trial, period. That request was never made. My client testified, Ms. O'Hare testified, that her overtime was not mandatory, that she chose to work overtime because she needs to pay her attorney, and that she had a choice in that matter and was choosing to do the overtime. She also testified that it may or may not continue. She had no way to know.
And there was no contrary testimony from the employer or something else from the father to show that the overtime was mandatory?
No, Your Honor. They were not contesting that subject at all.
And you say father's counsel basically conceded that he wasn't asking for the overtime, he or she wasn't asking for the overtime to be included?
That is correct, Your Honor. That is on page 97 of the transcript from the July 5, 2012 proceedings. So because the respondent's counsel never argued that the petitioner's overtime pay was mandatory at the trial court level, it would be impossible for the trial court to have abused its discretion or made any type of mistake concerning an issue that it never considered. As far as the child care expense, the petitioner testified that she was paying $910 per month for child care. That is on the transcript of the June 12 proceeding. Well, actually, the June proceeding in 2012, page 82 and 92, page 93. Her financial affidavit reflects an expense of $910 per month. What she testified was that the daycare provider was watching the children less under the new schedule. However, even though her schedule had been reduced, Ms. O'Hare and the child care provider both believed that her rate continued to be reasonable. In essence, they determined that the $910 for two children was an underpayment. So they did not adjust that child care amount. She continued to pay her child care provider $910 per month.
The provider was her mother, wasn't it?
Yes, Your Honor. And the court found that that $910 per month continued to be reasonable, but that was also based on an exhibit showing all the various daycare expenses in the area being either above or below that rate. So it was well within that range.
Okay.
As far as the health insurance premium goes, the respondent did not dispute the petitioner's calculation of health insurance in the trial management certificate. He attached a child support worksheet to the trial management certificate that contained a figure of zero for his health insurance expenses, and he did not include any amount at all in his financial statement. So the financial statement he was using at the trial had a figure of zero for his health insurance expenses. Instead, the respondent submitted Exhibit U at the trial. And if you look at that exhibit, it states right on the top of the first non-handwritten page that it is a medical expense estimator. On subsequent pages, Exhibit U states that the actual out-of-pocket cost may vary and that the numbers reflect the coverage that the respondent would receive if he did not make changes to his coverage.
And I asked counsel, was there any evidence of paychecks, pay stubs, actual payment of the medical insurance? She says there is. I didn't see them. I didn't see any references to them in the briefs.
Your Honor, I do not believe there were any references. Well, there were no references made by respondent's counsel. What happened was the respondent refused to give us the paycheck stubs, so we had to subpoena them, so we didn't have them before trial. But even if those amounts matched the amounts in Exhibit U, even if they did, it wouldn't matter because the respondent pays a different amount for his children than he does for himself. He pays more for just himself than he does for his children. So the $115 per month that we had used at the permanent orders, the amount that we used here in this modification hearing, that was based on documents showing exactly what was being paid for just the children. And the statute says that you only divide the actual numbers by the number of people if you don't have evidence of the amount actually being paid on the children's behalf. It's very common for parents to pay different amounts for their children's insurance than they do for themselves. So those figures in the paycheck stubs are really not persuasive. They're not going to give you a real number. All of the magistrate's rulings were based on real numbers, actual numbers that the magistrate used from the transcript, from the exhibits, from the testimony. They were supported by competent evidence, and they shouldn't be disturbed by this court. Very, very briefly, as far as the parenting time goes, vacation time was exactly what the respondent requested, and there's no evidence that the magistrate abused her discretion when she did not give the respondent every extra holiday that he requested. We are asking for attorney fees on appeal, Your Honors. This appeal is frivolous and groundless. This case has been litigated, the same issues over and over and over again. It shouldn't be here at the appellate court level, and nothing I heard today changes my argument that the appeal is frivolous and groundless. I am through unless you have questions.
I have one. You said that in your request for appellate attorney's fees that these issues have been litigated repeatedly, and you discussed before how the issues regarding property division have been litigated repeatedly. Is that also true with regard to the other issues?
No, Your Honor. The other issues have not been litigated repeatedly, so with that point, you're correct. But some of them weren't litigated at all at the trial court level. So in other words, the vacation time, she's now saying it's unclear, it's exactly what the respondent requested at trial. The many of these issues just did not appear. The reasonableness of attorney fees did not appear at the trial court level. So many of these issues are de minimis. Many of these issues concern an alleged abuse of discretion when there's record support for the magistrate's findings. And that is the basis for those issues being for Wisdom House.
Thank you, Counselor.
Thank you.
I would urge this court to look very closely at the motions that were filed prior to 2012. The motion that contested the language in the permanent orders was an objection to the proposed permanent orders. The motion that was filed after permanent orders was basically a motion to modify permanent orders, but was not based on the language of the personal property. I see I'm out of time. Thank you.
Thank you. This case will stand submitted. Counsel excused. An opinion will issue in due course. We appreciate your arguments today. And with that, I believe the clerk can announce the court is in recess.